My name's Loretta Van Pelt. I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I'm an organizer with the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar. That's one of the many things I do. I'm a mother, and I also work in the public schools as well. And I'm going to be your moderator for today's plenary. And this plenary is the first session. In this plenary, we'll be talking about the need for a movement for community control of police, the history behind the demand for community control of the police, and why the movement should get behind this. So I'll introduce our speakers. First on the panel will be Michael Sampson. He started out as an activist on the campus of Florida State University, where he co-founded multiple organizations, including Progress Coalition and the Dream Defenders. He has organized on issues regarding education rights, as well as combating police brutality and building a national movement for community control of the police. With the Dream Defenders, he was a part of the movement to demand justice for Trayvon Martin and ending the school-to-prison pipeline in Florida. He covered the Ferguson rebellions following the murder of Mike Brown, as well as the Baltimore rebellion following the murder of Freddie Gray by police for Fight Back News. Michael has organized in Tallahassee and D.C. and now organizes in his hometown of Jacksonville, Florida, where he helped start the Jacksonville Community Action Committee in 2017. And he's organizing for community control of the police there as well. Our second speaker will be Tanya Watkins. She's a mother, writer, black womanist, and community organizer and prison abolitionist, originally from Chicago's South Side. She studied writing and teaching and the teaching of writing at Columbia College, Chicago, with the intent of bringing innovative arts programs to schools in low-income communities of color. She's a former South Suburban Chicago elected official and serves as a presidential delegate in 2016. Tanya began as a leader with Southsiders Organized for Unity and Liberation, or SOUL, in 2010 with multi-issue faith-based social justice organizations that assist residents to build power in Chicago Southland. Since being with the organization, Tanya has led a multitude of campaigns demanding criminal justice reform and police accountability in Chicago, most notably heading up a series of strategic actions targeting former Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez in 2015. Currently, Tanya is the executive director of SOUL and SOUL in Action. Our third speaker is Frank Chapman. Frank was wrongfully convicted of murder and armed robbery in 1961 and sentenced to life and 50 years in the Missouri State Prison. In 1973, the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression took up Frank's case, and in 1976, he was released after being incarcerated for 15 years. Currently, he's a field organizer and an educational director of the Chicago Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, and he also published an autobiography, The Damn Don't Cry, Pages from the Life of a Black Prisoner and Organizer. And our fourth speaker, y'all know, she's phenomenal, is Angela Davis. She is an American political activist, academic scholar, and author from Birmingham. She emerged as a prominent countercultural activist during the late 1960s while working with the U.S. Communist Party and the Black Panther Party. She called for a national alliance to free other political prisoners. This is what led to the National Alliance Against Police and Racist Repression. And then in the 40 years, she's been a writer on the themes of women's rights and leadership, prisoners' rights and liberation politics, and anti-racism and gender equity and cultural studies as well, and has published many, many books. So this is our panel of speakers. Thank you. Without further ado, we're going to have our panelists speak.
I want to thank everybody for coming here. I definitely want to thank Loretta for that introduction. And I'm super excited to be a part of this panel. You know, when I found out I was going to be on a panel with Ms. Tanya Watkins, Frank Chapman, and Angela Davis, I really didn't know what to say. I think I need a few years in the game before I can even approach the stage. But I'm up here, and I'm happy to be up here. So as kind of Loretta was talking about in terms of my history, I guess I would kind of phrase myself as a child of the Trayvon Martin generation. You know, I started organizing back at the start of this decade. However, it was the Trayvon Martin murder by George Zimmerman, which kind of propelled me into the movement, and which I'm sure propelled a lot of folks in this room and a lot of folks who are not in this room into the movement as well. And this was at a time in which, you know, we just had our, a couple years after we had the election of our first African-American president, we thought that we were at a point in our country in which race relations and all that jazz was getting better. And, you know, this is me from an unconscious perspective, you know, kind of thinking that. But then you see what happened with Trayvon, his murder, and you see the mass movement that came out of that. It let us know that things are not okay, and, you know, racial oppression still exists, and we still have a lot to work on. So through that movement, I was able to plug in with 39 or so other individuals who decided to walk from Sanford, from Daytona Beach to Sanford, demanding justice for Trayvon Martin, which ended in a day of civil disobedience. And from that, you know, we started this organization called the Dream Defenders. Now, this was something that this organization and starting an organization, I was new to. You know, like I had been a part of other organizations, but kind of this was something much deeper, much different. This was black and brown folks like myself coming together, creating new structures, trying to make it happen. And through that experience, we had different experiences, which brought me to Ferguson, which brought me to Baltimore. And ultimately, it brings me to this stage, because it was through all those experiences, through all those different campaigns, you know, at the time of Trayvon Martin, we were demanding an end to racial profiling. You know, there was mass demands around, we need body cameras. You know, body cameras, you know, killer cop Darren Wilson had a body camera, we would know what happened. Or you had different forces of the movement demanding these different things, but none were demanding community control of the police. That wasn't, that had been a demand that was raised by the Black Panther Party and by the Alliance as well. The Black Panther Party actually pushed that and pushed a ballot initiative through that, but I hadn't learned about that in that time of my development. You know, we were still kind of demanding this cop we put in jail, we need Trayvon's law, we need racial profiling laws, and all the laws in the world, you know, we can demand all that, but, you know, power concedes nothing without a demand. And what is power? Power is a movement. Power is organized people. Power is the people in this room who have come together under the same ideology, the same goal, to free political prisoners and fight for community control of the police. And oftentimes, through all these, through the past few years, we've seen uprisings after in Ferguson with Mike Brown, all night, all day, we're going to march for Freddie Gray. You've seen the Baltimore rebellions. You've seen all these different mass upsurges. And even in Chicago, y'all saw a huge movement to demand justice for Laquan McDonald. And all that, all these movements leads me to the demand of why community control of the police is such a central thing we need to be pushing for all over the country. A lot of times you're here, you know, we aren't here to reform the police. No, this is not what we're doing. Community control of the police is not reforming the police. Oftentimes, the ruling class, the ruling elite, and also, you know, you have some folks, you know, liberals and whatnot, who want to limit the participation of the masses in the process. They want to limit the participation of the people in the process of having control over their lives. What community control of the police does is it puts the people in power over the institutions that control their lives. So I'm from Jacksonville, and Jacksonville is in the Black Belt, in the South, the heart of the South. Love that city, but it's Jacksonville, it's in the South. Jacksonville represent Duval. And one of the biggest things we see there is a huge upsurge in the amount of our taxpayer money going to fund more policing. Just this past year, we fought a campaign against 40% of our city's budget, $480 million going towards policing. Yet every day you see it, you know, rising crime and all that. We need more police on the streets. Well, what community control of the police does is it empowers our people to have a voice at the table. It empowers us to have democratic control over an institution which we fund, and oftentimes to the tune of 40% of every taxpayer dollar. You know, if this was any other institution, they'd be scrutinized. You know, if this was right now in our city, they're trying to scrutinize our public utility, JEA. They're trying to say that it should be privatized because it's not maximizing the dollars it spends. Yet, in every city, every police department gets so much money from the city, but there's no democratic control element that the people have a say-so in what happens. So community control of the police is that antidote. Community control of the police puts people in the driver's seat. It empowers working class people. It empowers our communities to have a voice at the table, to have a voice in how policies are written, to have a voice in who gets to govern our streets. And at the end of the day, that's what we're fighting for. We're fighting for a complete change in who runs society. And that's what community control of the police is to me. It's a means of putting the working people in a driver's seat in the vehicle that is our lives, that is our institutions, and that's what we fight for. So I've been inspired by the work here in Chicago. I've been inspired by work that's been done across the nation by other cities fighting for police accountability, and I think that's a movement that we need to keep expanding, and I'm so happy to be in this room with folks from 28 states, because a movement like this, if we keep growing it and keep getting bigger and keep getting larger, you know, we have no limits. So, thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. So before we start, I want to say two things. Number one, if you are offended by a few F-bombs, now might be the time to take a restroom break. Number two, I had to write all of my thoughts down because I never imagined that I would be sitting this close to one of my heroes. And I was so scared that I would get up here and forget how to talk. All right? So bear with me. Understand that although I am a Christian, God ain't done with me yet. My name is Tanya Watkins, and I'm the executive director of Southsiders Organized for Unity and Liberation, also known as SOUL. And an executive board member of the Black Roots Alliance, an organization dedicated to building independent political power across Illinois. SOUL is a proud sponsor of the conference to refound the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. In 2013, SOUL embarked on a simple campaign, exposed the racist practices of Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez. Under her leadership, it was clear that there were thousands of people locked up in Cook County jail simply because they were poor and black. Over the next few years, we flooded her office with requests for meetings. We organized more than 10 direct actions against her and the racist Chicago Police Department. All the while, we had no idea that the ground was swelling beneath our feet. A perfect and tragic storm was brewing. A 17-year-old black teenager had been brutally murdered on Chicago's southwest side at the hands of police, and there was a video. In 2015, we organized a 1,000-person counterconference in direct action where organizations from across the country convened against the International Association of Chiefs of Police. Many of our comrades took a rest that day as we called for the resignation of one Miss Anita Alvarez. And on November 24, 2015, we stood outside her office to double down on our demands. That tape dropped. And it was more horrific than we could have ever imagined. That night, Quite naturally, there was an uproar. Thousands of young black folks and allies took to the streets to demand justice and an end to their trauma. Because of our immense pressure, Anita Alvarez reluctantly charged Jason Van Dyke with murder on the next day. He was released on bail 5 days later with help from his supporters and the Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police. But that was too little too late. Alvarez was not going quietly, and we knew that her office would work diligently to protect a killer cop. So began our journey to flip the f*** out the prosecutor's seat. We knocked on over 13,000 doors and had conversations with more than 5,000 voters about their vision for criminal justice in Cook County. With our partners in Black Roots Alliance, we collectively registered nearly 30,000 voters. And on March 15, 2016, a young black lawyer who had grew up in Chicago's projects with a once drug-addicted mother was elected as Cook County's first black woman state's attorney. One of the first of several progressive prosecutors to snatch seats around the country. For many of us, we naively assumed that our work was done. We assumed that the election of one progressive prosecutor would deliver us from the evil and reverse the decades upon decades of systemic harm that had been handed down to us by the hands of the police. What we quickly realized was how badly we were mistaken. As the names flashed across our social media feeds of the countless black folks still being tortured and murdered by police, the stark reality forced us to have even more conversations, to dig deeper into Chicago's massive police problem. We found out three things. Number one, Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police was more powerful than we had ever imagined and was determined to keep its stronghold on our city. Number two, white supremacy and white nationalism was deeply embedded into the fabric of policing in this country, and that they had virtually been trained to kill black people and terrorize our communities. And number three, there was no question that our relatively young organization had been asking the questions that had already been asked by the Alliance. Yes. The Alliance had already done the painstaking groundwork, and they had laid out a path to ease the grasp of policing around the necks of our people through CPAC. And thus began our love affair with folks like Frank Chapman, Joe Isabaker, Take On Hate, the Arab American Action Network, and our dear, dear friends at Black Lives Matter Chicago. And the other radical freedom fighters that sit at the Chicago Alliance table. This love affair has catapulted our analysis around policing and forced us to drastically reconsider what safety means to our communities. And my personal political learning has been this. As we fight to pass incremental reforms to the system, we must do this through an unapologetic lens that rejects the idea that reformism is enough. And while we accept that the trees are these incremental reforms, we must be clear that the forest beyond those trees is full-on abolition. I hear you. The word abolition is hard for many to digest, but I refuse to believe that a bunch of folks who came out here to see Dr. Davis would have the audacity to sit here and rest in their own reformism. So I am going to assume that everybody came here to have a real conversation. So before we get agitated, I want to do a really quick exercise with everybody. So I want you to close your eyes, and I want you to relax. Take yourself back to a moment in time, a moment in your life that you can remember where you felt absolutely safe. You may have to dig deep into the file cabinet of your childhood memories, and you may struggle with this because safety has been so unimaginable for so many of us. Who's there with you in this moment? What are the sounds that you hear? What does it smell like where you are? And allow yourself to fall back into that time. And when you have that memory of your safe moment, I want you to just open your eyes. Did anyone's memory include their family? You can just raise your hand. Wow. So who was in a home, like a house, in their memory? Anybody? Who could smell food cooking in the kitchen? That was my memory, because you know, I likes to eat. Who could hear the voices of somebody that they loved? Now, by a show of hands, whose memory had police in it? Nobody? Oh. Yeah, that's because police don't fucking keep us safe. Beyond its historically racist ties, even if we ignore the harmful actions of the union, we must at the very least recognize that no organization whose only real function is to catch people after they committed a crime and whose very economic sustainability is dependent on there being community-based harm can actually be dedicated to the prevention of harm. Harm is what literally feeds this system. So why would the institution of policing and incarceration ever be a body that we depend on to keep us safe? Police in our communities are not there to keep us safe. They are there to fucking bother us. They exist to agitate our communities to a place of fear and complacency. They have tricked us into believing that we heal from harm only by enacting equal or greater harm to those who have hurt us. They have tricked us into believing that cages and state-sanctioned violence rehabilitate people. They have forced us to abandon the idea that survivors are entitled to actual restitution and healing and must leave that on the table in exchange for paying systems where people sit in prisons to provide free labor to million-dollar corporations. They have bamboozled us into believing that these slave camps keep us safe. While we refuse to contend with the fact that as we pump more money into policing and detention, that crime rates in our community actually go up. While they force us to be afraid of that word, abolition, we don't understand what a world could look like, not just without prisons, but one where we wouldn't need them. Prison abolition is a political vision with the goal of eliminating imprisonment, policing, and surveillance, and creating lasting alternatives to punishment and imprisonment. Prison abolition is not a world devoid of accountability. It is, however, a worldview that prioritizes investment in the resources that keep us safe, as opposed to violent, oppressive, and ultimately ineffective means of punishment. But my friends, how do we get there? The only path forward is community control of police. This political moment that brought us here today must put a period at the end of the sentence pertaining to the solution to police violence. We must recognize that the system will refuse to shrink itself, so we have to fucking shrink it. And while we continue to chip away at the system, it is our responsibility to concurrently dream and design and build new systems. Let's not leave our liberation in the hands of people that hate us. So let us be focused on building this political power over these next few days, knowing full on that when we fight, we win. So is ready to put in all this work with y'all. Are you ready? Awesome.
All right. Mr. Tanya. All right. Mr. Tanya. Yeah. She didn't need nothing for me to say. We're not in church, so I'm not going to say just amen. Sister Tanya dealt with the details, a lot of the details of our oppression, but she also dealt with the solution to our problem. We She said, nobody delivers us. Well, what that means is we have to deliver ourselves.
That's right. That's right.
We are not responsible for our oppression. We are responsible for our liberation. We can't give that job to nobody but us. And the National Alliance Against Racism and Political Repression is being refounded under new conditions, under new circumstances, in a new time in history. Because we still see the need to organize a mass defense movement that makes sure that our liberation movements are not destroyed. You know, we saw people get assassinated. They say the movement died out. The movement kind of toned down. People lost their enthusiasm. The movement was killed.
Right.
It was systematically and deliberately murdered in many ways by this government. But it wasn't quite killed because you can't kill the movement.
That's right. That's right.
I agree with Fred Hampton on one thing in particular. You can kill the revolutionary, but you can't kill the revolution. We wouldn't be sitting here today if COINTELPRO and all of that would have successfully destroyed us. We're here because it didn't. But we can't get relaxed. We have to fight back and win. We have to fight back and win. And I just want to speak about that winning for just a second. Keep me up on the time, too, because I'm going to cut mine in half. When we started out on this campaign for an all-elected All-Civilian Police Accountability Council, we started out in a little small room in Inglewood on the south side called Teamwork Inglewood. We had 150 people in the room. That packed the room, because the room only held about 100. And we knew by that response, which was mostly families. Is the Hernandez family here today? I want to recognize the Hernandez family. Melissa McKinney's came all the way here from St. Louis. She's a Ferguson activist. I'm going to have to mention this, Sister McKenzie. I know it's painful. Her son was hung. She's going to talk to you about this in some detail, and she came in to get our support. You know, she is committed to this struggle. It's people like her and the other families out there. If I didn't mention you, I'm acknowledging you now. Yeah, I acknowledge that. That's the Hernandez. There she is, right there. With people like Melissa McKenzie, Esther Hernandez, Bertha Escamilla, is Dorothy Holmes here? Dorothy Holmes, these are the people who are the fuel of our movement. We are here. But see, the Alliance is not like a lot of groups. We don't only get inspired by them, we incorporate them as a part of us. We invite them into the struggle with us. Because they know we're getting out of this here without fighting. You can't buy your way out of oppression, and no offense to anybody. You can't pray and hope your way out of it either.
No, you cannot.
You got to fight your way out of it. And that's what we are about doing. And let me just give you a report from the battlefield. Here's a report from the battlefield. We went from 150 in that room in 2012 to 60,000. 60,000. That's what we went to. We went to 60,000. And then after we got to the 60,000, you know what we did? We had an election here. And they thought they were going to get away with some more bullshit on us. But what we did in that election, we increased our ranks another 176,000. We elected new people to the Board of Aldermen. We went from 8 aldermen supporting CPAC to 19. 19. We over doubled our number. We are now 40% of the city council.
That's right.
They used to call us the lunatic fringe. They said, that's a lunatic fringe. Well, a lunatic fringe is now 40%.
That's right.
40%. That's a report from the battlefield. That's what we're doing. This is the way you make change. This is the way you build movements. This is the way you do it. Maya Angelou talked about the hope and the dream of the slave. That's how she described us. We're fighting. But she was describing those of us who were fighting when she said, you are the hope and the dream of the slave. She wasn't talking about those who are not fighting. Those who are waiting on a dream. She's talking about us. I only have one problem with that word dream. You have to be asleep to have it. Wake up. Let's fight. All right?
But I do think I want to take issue with one thing you said.
Uh-oh.
Because I think we can dream with our eyes wide open. And, you know, I just recently, a couple of days ago on Thursday, participated in a memorial for Toni Morrison. And Toni was someone who taught us how to dream. And I mention her name because she also participated in an event sponsored by the Chicago Alliance. I don't know if anybody remembers that. It was back in the 80s, maybe the early 80s. It was before she wrote Beloved, so before she was the internationally acclaimed author. But I thought what I would do is try to emphasize the importance of dreaming and learning. You know, sometimes we have to stop and think deeply about where we are. Because if we don't, we end up replicating, you know, over and over and over again. Without any significant change. And of course, as we all know, the struggle against police violence, police crimes, dates all the way back to slavery. I mean, we can begin by, you know, talking about the slave catchers and the slave patrols and how the structure of the slave catchers and slave patrols got reenacted in policing in the aftermath of slavery. I can tell the story of my entire trajectory as an activist by looking at cases of black people who have been who were killed either by the police or by vigilantes. So that is something that has been with us for centuries. I want to join you, Tanya, and talk a little bit about abolition.
Okay.
You already did an amazing job. But I think what I've been doing in this conference is also reflecting back on the history that led us to where we are. And, you know, some of the people who have been key to keeping movements alive that allowed us to do what we're doing today. And I think it's so important to remember those people. And And I was thinking about another organization I was involved with from the very beginning, Critical Resistance. And I want to share with you the words of a woman by the name of Rose Braz, who ran the organization Critical Resistance for many years until her death. And she was asked, what does abolition mean? And she said, CR, Critical Resistance, seeks to abolish the prison industrial complex. The use of prisons, policing, and the largest system of the prison industrial complex as an answer to what are social, political, and economic problems. You know, oftentimes we think about the prison industrial complex as the prison. But the reason for using a broader term is to urge us to think about all of the connections, the connection with the police, the connection with the politicians who always scream law and order, the connection with the corporations who profit from the soaring numbers of people in prison. She went on to say, abolition defines both the goal we seek and the way we do our work today. Abolition means a world where we do not use prisons, policing, and the larger system of the prison industrial complex as an answer to what are social, political, and economic problems. Abolition means that instead we put in place the things that would reduce incidents of harm at the front end and address harm in a non-punitive manner when harm does occur. Abolition means that harm will occur far less often, and that when harm does occur, we address the causes of that harm rather than rely on the failed solutions of punishment. Thus, abolition is taking a harm reductionist approach to our society's problems. Abolition, finally, abolition means creating sustainable, healthy communities empowered to create safety and rooted in accountability instead of relying on police, courts, and imprisonment, which are not creating safe communities. You already said that. And so I think it's important for us to reflect deeply about what that means. And as we call for community control of the police, we should also have a larger vision that allows us to understand that we're actually moving toward new forms of safety and security. Because, you know, what does it mean to have to guarantee security or safety with violence? Which is what is producing the unsafe conditions. And of course, these are the contradictions in the whole prison industrial complex and the punitive institutions that are embraced by it, that we try to create safety by putting people in very unsafe conditions. We try to address violence by turning them over to institutions that are responsible for the continued production and reproduction of violence. People often assume that when you say you're an abolitionist, it means that you are totally opposed to any kind of reform, as if somehow or another at, you know, the strike of midnight, we're going to get rid of the police and get rid of prisons, and then we'll be somewhere else. The question is, how do we get there without constantly reproducing the very ideas that have put us in the grip of prisons and police in the first place. This is, you know, one of the reasons why everybody really responded to, indict, what was it, indict the killer cops? Okay, indict.
The whole damn system is guilty as
hell. Okay. Okay. That's it. Okay. And I totally understand why we say that. Because it makes us feel powerful. It makes us feel as if we can really accomplish something. But, you know, sometimes we also at the same time have to ask ourselves, where is that impulse coming from? And how is it that we are using the very structure and the very strategies that are responsible for what we are fighting against? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
And I think, you know, sometimes people might think of that as a contradiction. I don't think of it as a contradiction, because I guess, you know, it's okay to say that, but then you have to realize, why am I saying that? Why does that make me feel so good? You know, why? How is it that the very structures of imprisonment and policing have made their way into our own emotional reactions? So abolition urges us to become aware of that and to think deeply about the ways in which we often accomplish the goal of the state, even as we are attempting to challenge it. And it urges us not to be afraid of contradictions. And, you know, feminist strategies are really important because they teach us that we can inhabit contradictions. We can be right there at the center of contradictions, and something very powerful can come out of that. So we don't have to assume that either we're abolitionists and want to tear the whole damn system down, or over here we're reformists. And I've got 30 seconds, so, and I haven't even looked at my notes, so. Oh, Frank said that was 30 seconds ago. So, you know, I'll just say one final sentence. I think particularly during this period, we have to think deeply and recognize that as we engage in this activism, we're producing new knowledge. We're producing new ways of looking at the world. We wouldn't be where we are today if people hadn't done that before us. But let me end by saying, let's move toward community control of and then abolition of policing and prison.
Okay, so thank you all once again for that. So this is the question and answer period. I know if you still have questions, the first one, maybe everybody take like a minute or so to answer it. Is that cool? Okay, a lot of existing community police oversight do not actually hold police accountability, i.e. CCPA, and then I can't really read the handwriting, in Chicago. How do we address part failed attempts at community control oversight of police? And then so the second one is, what do we do about people in our communities that kill and prey on innocent people, on vulnerable and innocent people? Who would protect those people? And then the third question is, can we talk about the connection between the military and police?
I answered the last one, the military and the police. That's a good one. I mean, in the sense that our military serves as a foreign occupation force and oppressing other nations, self-determination, one could say that the police plays an internal occupation force in our communities. My father recently passed away. He had a saying, serve and protect. In the white neighborhoods, they serve, they protect. In the black neighborhoods, they patrol. And that's kind of the function of how they kind of react the same. And even, I believe, how the police are even being militarized now shows that, it shows the sharpening contradictions amongst the masses and with the police. So with that, you're going to see more intense repression, which is why we must stay organized. In regards to the question on what do you do with people who kill and pray and blah, 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 I mean, I think it's always important to understand the systemic roots of all harms and all crime. Oftentimes, which is why I brought up in my presentation about, you know, in Jacksonville, we have $500,000 that goes towards public mental health, while $480 million goes towards the police. Or you have certain amount of city money or budgeting that doesn't go towards addressing harm reduction or addressing the root of crime, but it goes towards more incarceration and more policing. So I think before we talk about what do we do with the killers and stuff in our neighborhoods, what do we do with them, we have to think about what is the institutions doing to create a scenario and create a situation in which people are being put in a vulnerable position to do crimes, you know? We often don't think about that and make that connection. And I think the how do we address these existing review boards, I think folks in Chicago, y'all have done a great job with that, so I will yield to y'all on that.
I'm going to answer backwards. The question's backwards. So I refer to the military as International 12, and that's all I'm going to say about that. And when we talk about, you know, and we get that question a lot, what do we do, you know, with murderers, with people who, you know, make us feel unsafe? And I think that we have to contend about how we look at harm as making things better, right? My friend Lola from Arizona, who's a dope organizer, she had brought up this. She's with Mass Liberation in Arizona, and she had said something that I was like, that's brilliant. She said, I don't know if any of you, when I was growing up, and like I was like a little kid, like a toddler, I would like trip and hit my head on like a table or something, and like I would start crying. And so my grandmother would hit the table. Anybody's mama do that? They would hit the table, be like, bad table. And then she would look at me, and I would assume that because she hit the table, I was supposed to be better. Now, I still had a big-ass hickey on the side of my head. But I looked at her, and I stopped crying. And so we are conditioned to believe that harm equates to healing for us. And that is just not necessarily the case. It's not the case at all. So we take folks who have been harmed, we drag them to a courtroom, we make them tell their story, and we re-traumatize them over and over and over again. And when we lose a loved one, when we lose a moment of our dignity, when our property is stolen, even if that person is locked up forever, we don't get that back. And so what if we created systems that actually addressed the harm to the person who committed harm and the harm to the survivor, right? We actually leave survivors completely broken. And so when I talk about abolition, I tell people, I am not a humanitarian. I question sometimes if I'm even a nice person. I eat meat. If I see a roach in my house, I'm gonna kill it. You know what I'm saying? So this does not come from like a deep place of like tender humanity. But it's just not working. No matter how many murderers we lock up, we're not stopping murder, right? But be clear that for, and maybe there are some folks, I can't talk about everybody's school of abolition, but I do think sometimes people just need a minute. That minute ain't got to be in a cage. If my friend who's in the audience, Cleopatra, she stood up and started slapping everybody in this room, just slapping y'all, pat, 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 I would actually absolutely want Cleopatra to stop slapping people, right? I would say, Cleopatra, take a minute before you get to me, because I don't want to be slapped, right? And what I would do is I would find out, Cleopatra, why are you slapping people, right? I would say, what happened in your life that brought you to this point? And I will say, with all the billions of dollars that we pay to the government, what can we invest in you so that you will never slap somebody again? It's that simple. And so I think the question was, how do we deal with failed attempts at police accountability boards, right? And as organizers, what we understand is sometimes we build things with people that are ineffective, and they can get these motherfucking hands too, right? We have to continuously criticize the systems even if we create it. We have to hold people accountable even if they are our people, and sometimes we have to go back to the drawing board and do it all over again.
I think it might be helpful to look at some of the ways in which people who have been involved in the anti-violence movement, the women's anti-violence movement, have come to think about this issue. You know, if you assume that a person who commits an act of sexual violence or some other act of violence is going to be helped by being in prison in a situation in which all forms of violence, including sexual violence, are linked to the way the institution functions, then of course, then you're absolutely wrong. And historically, of course, women have often experienced a second assault at the hands of the police. So you experience a sexual assault, you call the police looking for some remedy, and then the act is performed all over again. And then besides, even if the person does end up going to prison, will that have anything to do with the effort to eradicate sexual violence from the planet? Or will it serve instead to reproduce the possibilities of sexual violence? So I think it would be interesting to look at an organization like Insight and the ways in which they have developed strategies that do not rely on the state, that do not rely on the police. You know, when we talk about community control of the police, we also have to talk about dealing with the fact that we have been completely de-skilled when it comes to addressing issues that we can address ourselves without the intervention of the police. So I think it would be really interesting to think about, you know, what it means to call for community control of the police and at the same time begin to institute measures that allow the community to address issues without the intervention of the police. Now, the second question was the militarization of the military and the police?
Talk about the connection between the military and police.
And last night, when I evoked the role that Israel has played in militarizing police all over the world, not just in the U.S., and not just big police departments, but small police, like Ferguson. The Ferguson police, the head of the Ferguson police, had been trained by the Israeli army. And so I think we have to learn how to be much more capacious, have a much larger view of what it means to do work against the police. It's not just the police, Chicago Police Department. It's not just the Ferguson Police Department. It's police all over the world that have been recruited into this into counterinsurgency approaches that not only continue to produce Islamophobia, but that, you know, what it means is that the racism that we used to attribute to the police is a much deeper kind of racism today. It's not just the racism that goes back to slavery. It's the racism that defines people who practice Islam as potential terrorists. So I guess what I'm saying is we have to complicate our ways of thinking about this. And then the last question, failed attempts. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of failures. But sometimes I think we learn more from our failures than we learn from our victories. You know? Because if we do it right, we just assume we've done it right. There's nothing left to do. But if we don't do it right, then that makes us think a lot more deeply and try to figure out, you know, what went wrong. So let's not assume that failures are just failures to be left into the past. Failures help us create our present agendas.
Can you talk more about the contradictions in and between movements, and what are your suggestions for working across social, ideological, and organizational differences towards a shared goal? And should we consider community patrol groups to help to surveil police as well as criminals who are predators to our neighborhoods?
So I'm going to request that Frank answer the CPAC question.
Okay. Also, let me remind you that we're going to have breakouts and workshops, so a lot of these questions should be dealt with more deeply there, and it'll also be more manageable because it'll be fewer of us in those breakouts. What is the key difference between CPAC and other police accountability measures? Well, it's real accountability. That's the main difference. You know, you can't have accountability when you're allowing the police to be the ones who are governing the accountability. You can't have anything but a worm if the worm is investigating its tail. So what CPAC does is not a cure-all. We're going to make a lot of mistakes with CPAC. We already have, and there are going to be more. But at least we know that we're stumbling forward. Because the main question is this, and this is what these other accountability people do not take into account. We don't rule them out of the movement, you know. We want to work with them, but we also want to work with them honestly. Here's what they don't take into account: is who has control over who polices our communities and how our communities are policed. We don't. That's what CPAC is fighting for. It's fighting for that definitive voice that says who polices our communities and how they are policed. Once we get control of the institution, or once we seriously start engaging in controlling, all these other questions that Angela has addressed and others have addressed are going to pop up in the course of practice, what we're doing, you know. But at least we're going into this here with a vision, and we're going into it with our eyes open, and we're going into it understanding that until you have a reform that changes the power relationships between those who oppress us and us, then it's very piecemeal. Very piecemeal. The only reforms that are going to take us forward on our path are those which address the power relationships between those, between ourselves and those who are over us. And we're saying, take that power away from the police.
Should we consider community patrol groups to help to surveil police as well as criminals who are predators to our neighborhood? And then can you talk more about the contradictions in and between our movements and what are suggestions for working across social, ideological, and organizational differences towards a shared goal?
So I answered the latter in regards to the contradictions between different organizations and working towards the same goal. I think, you know, in this movement is filled of organizations, different mission statements, different tactics, different goals, et cetera, et cetera. I think our common basis of unity should always be the action we're willing to take to accomplish our shared goal. You'll come across 20 different groups who may all have the same thing, say the same thing, same line, same education program, same ideology, same Facebook logo, stuff like that. But the biggest difference is going to be, and the basis of our commonality and us working together should always be the steps and the actions we're willing to take. You know, we aren't just interested in having, this conference isn't just for us to come and talk about how things are messed up. Oh, this sucks. This is bad. See you tomorrow. See y'all next year. No, we're at this conference because everybody in this city is a mover and shaker in their cities. They take action. They organize the people. They engage the people. We're going to come out of this conference with action plans to engage the people. That is going to be our commonality, our basis of unity, the action plans we're willing to take together based on this to move forward. And I think that's really the main thing we have to look at. Plenty of organizations have ideological difference. Plenty of organizations have difference between the membership. Leadership may be different. The tweets may be different. But what's going to bring us together is the action we're willing to take together to move forward to the common goal.
Yeah, I do think that people should be creating all sorts of organizations to have different functions, you know, and work within their own capacity. You know, the people on the other side, they have arms everywhere. And so sometimes we believe that we always have to do the same thing the same way in order to be successful. That's actually not true at all. We need to do all the things. So if you want to watch my back, watch it. If you want to watch the cops, watch them too, right? So these community organizations, I think that they absolutely have value if that's within your capacity to do. And that also kind of bleeds into the other question, is that where I sit, people are like, we got to come together. We got to come together to get anything done. We don't always have to come together. Organizations, from what I've experienced, have clashed, not due to a difference in ideology, it is a difference in personalities within the organization, right? We have to understand that we can work together on issues without being best friends. The people on the other side all hate each other, but they still get done because they can put that aside and put in the work. We also have to be intentional about what trauma we bring into these spaces personally. Baby, a year into the movement, I was like, ooh, let me go get a therapist. Because I am showing up in a very particular way. And years later, I've been through three therapists, but bet you by golly, I am there at least once a week. Learning how to really manage my own trauma in these spaces and in relationship to people who are showing up in theirs. And so we talk about healing as if it is some like magical word or it just kind of happens. I'm healed. That is not what happens. We have to be intentional about doing our internal work so that we can show up for our comrades in a real way and not be toxic in these spaces. Ooh. Ooh. And so even though Frank touched on, you know, why CPAC is different, you know, for everybody, they had different reasons for feeling like this is how we need to support. I have not read every ordinance, but I've read a couple. And they are so convoluted and filled with bureaucracy. I got halfway through it and I was like, I ain't reading this shit. I don't understand it. And if it's not accessible to community, it ain't gonna work. If we have to go through 17 layers and committees and the people appointed, one person got to be a barber, one person got to be a butcher on this board, a baker, a candlestick maker. I was like, what is this? And so if it is not accessible, it is going to be ineffective. If I can't read it, it ain't for me. Another thing that was important about this space with the Alliance is, unlike other organizations who are moving or trying to move criminal justice ordinance, they understand the power of the FOP and the police union contract. We cannot control the police without controlling their union. They are one of the strongest political forces in this country. Between their members and their employees, they give millions of dollars to political candidates. And they will always be controlled by that union. And their contract does not necessarily just protect labor, because I'm all for unions. But when your contract protects murder, we got to have a conversation. And so the people of CPAC have not left that stone, there's an F in that word, Tanya, left that stone unturned.
Well, I think Mike and Tanya have already done a great job of responding to those questions. I just want to say, I remember when Huey Newton and Bobby Seale began that whole process of patrolling the community with, you know, a gun and with a law book. And I think community patrol can be very important. Nowadays, everybody has cell phones. So often it is the case when some form of police violence happens, someone is there to capture it. I guess I would say I just don't want us to always think only about defensive measures. You know, how can we engage in community control of the police in order to guarantee that certain kinds of actions do not take place? You know, it's interesting. It used to be that there was no way to imagine a cop actually being charged, particularly when it comes to the killing of a black person. And we've somewhat begun to address that. The police are now in a position of defense in many places. And I think we need to take advantage of that. The FOP used to be able to make decisions regarding everything, including people like Mumia Abu-Jamal. He was on death row for so many years precisely because of the work that the FOP did. Now there is a possibility of freeing Mumia. And I think that in the context of doing work around community control of the police, we need to take on cases like Mumia's and use that, because it's, you know, it's terrible. People all over Europe know Mumia Abu-Jamal. There are streets named after him in Germany, in France. But here in the U.S., we're still struggling to enlighten people about the conditions that have led this amazing brother to spend half of his life or more behind bars. Let's not get stuck in strategies that work at a particular moment in history. But we don't have to assume that they're going to work later. There are those who say, well, we just need a new Black Panther Party. I guess there is a new Black Panther Party. And they do good work. They do some good work. But we can't simply import conditions that emerged at one moment in history to another. So, I think abolition of the police is the demand that we should be making now. I think that's the overarching demand. And we should also be thinking about harm reduction strategies. Yes. Harm reduction strategies that can be embraced by communities that will not have to rely on the intervention of the police. So one question is, how do we make police obsolete? How do we control them to obsolescence, I guess?
Let's thank the panel. We thank the panel, and we're going to take a 5-minute break before we start the next panel.